Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, a senior editor at The New Yorker. Nearly 2 years into his presidency, Joe Biden, with an executive order, announced a plan to forgive up to $20,000 of student debt for millions of borrowers. This plan, the first mass student debt cancellation of its kind, has been estimated by the Congressional Budget Office to cost a staggering $400 billion. As you would imagine, this figure has freaked a lot of people out, and earlier this week, the first legal challenge to the policy was filed, a lawsuit from a conservative law firm defending a plaintiff who claims that the plan is illegal and that it will force borrowers in some states to pay taxes on the forgiven amount. And that's only the beginning. Republican lawmakers have pledged to keep the challenges coming, to chip away at the policy, and perhaps to even take it to the Supreme Court. My colleague, Andrew Morantz, has written about the politics of student debt for NewYorker.com. He joins me today to discuss whether Biden's debt relief policy will have electoral influence or any staying power. Hi, Andrew. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there's been a lot of pressure on Biden to forgive student loans, you know, going back to the campaign trail. The student debt relief movement has been around since Occupy Wall Street in 2011, but I don't really remember the same kind of pressure being put on Obama by mainstream Democrats to forgive federal loans. So how did this become, you know, like a mainstream policy position for the Democrats?
Yeah, that's totally true. And I think there were a lot of things like this where the issue was kind of germinating, but it wasn't a big deal under Obama, I think largely because the left wasn't a big deal under Obama. You know, when you read Obama's memoir, he doesn't really talk about the left that much. He talks about how can I get Republicans on board? How can I get conservative Democrats on board? And then he mentions Bernie like two times in this 700-page book. So that sort of just speaks to how this movement wasn't a major force in mainstream politics yet. And so, you know, you bring up Occupy Wall Street. I wrote about how the idea of full-scale student debt relief was basically born there in terms of its entry into American politics. And at the time, it was a thing people talked about at Occupy Wall Street and sort of nowhere else. I mean, even Bernie Sanders didn't support it back then. And like a lot of things, like a Green New Deal, like housing for all, Medicare for all, you know, all these things, they kind of gathered steam over time. It was building ideological and political consensus. And 10 years later, you had Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, all these people vocally supporting it and also running for president. And that was in 2020. And they pushed Joe Biden into adopting, as Joe Biden was wont to do, a kind of slightly watered down version of their policy. So at one point in the primaries, when Biden was not winning, he was trying to court the left and he said, I promised to do a version of Senator Warren's student debt relief proposal. And that won him a bit of support on the left. And then when he was in office, he was faced with the question of, okay, am I actually going to uphold this campaign promise?
So Warren was promising to cancel all student debt, right? And then, as you said, Biden sort of offered a watered down version of that. What is like the difference between what she was, you know, advocating for and what other proponents of student debt forgiveness have been, you know, calling for, and then what Biden has actually done?
So I think in my memory, like Bernie was saying, let's cancel all of it. Warren was saying, let's cancel up to $50,000 of debt for every borrower or something like that. And then Biden said, let's cancel up to $10,000. And he would sometimes say for all borrowers, and he would sometimes say for borrowers who make under a certain amount. This is kind of like a classic Democratic trope, right? Where there is a progressive wing of the party that is just offering a big universal program, which is like the way it would work in Europe, you know, take this thing that shouldn't exist and abolish it, or take this social safety net benefit that should exist for everyone and give it to everyone. And then a sort of mainstream centrist Dem comes along and says, well, now, you know, let's not be crazy. Let's give a quarter of that in the form of a tax rebate to a certain subset of borrowers who fit a certain description. This is like almost a tick, I think, at this point with the sort of centrist wing of the party. I remember there was one Kamala Harris proposal that was kind of pilloried on the campaign trail that was like, we will give you a tax rebate if you make between $44,000 and $88,000 and you live in a certain kind of suburban neighborhood. And it was just kind of the apotheosis of this logic. So yeah, I mean, I think student debt is a very clear example of this. The left wanted to say, it's immoral to saddle people with this debt that can't be expunged. let's get rid of it. And they would make this kind of complex, almost metaphysical economic argument that would basically be, we're not really costing money to the taxpayer because we're just adjusting the government's own ledgers. You know, basically the government brought the debt into this world, it can take it out of it. And then the centrist, more kind of austerity, you know, not to use the word, but neoliberal wing of the party would say, no, no, you can't do that. Let's be realistic. And this, I think, goes to like a very deep ideological, not just rhetorical, but ideological divide in the party, where there are some people who want to be more like a European social safety net style robust welfare state. And there are other people who just fundamentally don't believe that that's fiscally responsible, or I mean, even morally responsible. And they are just sort of saddled with being in the same party.
So Biden's decision not to cancel just all student debt across the board, I mean, do you think that that was definitely a financial decision as opposed to a legal one? Because I've also seen various things sort of questioning whether the president can, you know, actually wipe away all student debt, even though advocates have been saying that, you know, the president can definitely do that and does not need Congress on board in order to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. So the advocates' position started as a moral position. Mm-hmm. They just said, this debt is immoral and we should have a jubilee and get rid of it. And then in the years between Occupy and sort of them nudging their ways toward the halls of power and actually sitting down and having meetings with sitting senators and White House staffers and stuff, they had to put this legal piece of the reasoning into their ask. And so they found this kind of obscure old provision of the Higher Education Act, which was passed in 1965, and which, I'm just going to quote it, it gives the Secretary of Education the authority to, quote, enforce, pay, compromise, waive, or release any right, title, claim, lien, or demand. So then, you know, you get into the debate over what do those words mean. And the activists were saying that those words mean that the executive branch has basically plenary power to wipe out the debt that it created. And then there were more cautious people within the executive who thought, this is contestable, we will be taken to court and we might lose. And so they were hesitant to do it. So there was both a fiscal argument that, you know, this might be inflationary. And there was also a political argument that this might cause a backlash, it might cause some sort of resentment. And then there was this legal argument that, you know, nothing like this has been done before and we don't know. And so the activist position was not only this is legal under the 1965 Higher Education Act, but also who cares if you get sued? Like, Republicans are going to sue you no matter what. And if you're in a fight where you're trying to get rid of people's debt and they're trying to stop you, the politics are on your side.
Yeah, the compromise that Biden has landed on is still a pretty, I mean, staggering amount. And, you know, I guess there's this question of whether it actually costs $500 billion or whether it's just $500 billion that, you know, is just not really being asked back, you know, in the way that it would have been before. And so I feel like, you know, you've conservatives arguing that the policy puts this expense of college on taxpayers who didn't go to college and that the plan's going to contribute to inflation. And then there's the liberal argument that debt cancellation will actually help the economy because it'll facilitate spending by people who used to be saddled with loans. I'm wondering how you've been thinking about this issue and if there are any arguments for or against student debt forgiveness that you found like particularly compelling.
Yeah. Well, so I think at this point, certainly in the Biden presidency, I think we've seen that inflation is a real thing and inflation affects working class people. So it's not something to be glib about. And I'm not an economist, but I understand that there are real arguments about what is or isn't inflationary. And the fact is, we just don't really know. It's economics is not as much of a science as people pretend it is. And it just doesn't have perfect predictive power. But the counterargument that makes the most sense to me is that this isn't getting to the root of the problem, that, you know, you wash away this debt and the higher education system in this country is still an unsustainable bubble. I think that's largely true, but I also think it doesn't necessarily excuse not solving the low-hanging fruit, right? Mm-hmm. So the medical system in this country is also a total mess, but I still think you should give people healthcare, right? So, you know, politics is about sort of solving one problem at a time. And so the fact that this doesn't solve everything is compelling. I think we should solve all those problems, but it's not fatal to me.
Do you think that this could actually make the problem of higher education costs worse? So the plan that Biden has proposed will also change the way that loan repayment works going forward. And so, you know, borrowers will be responsible for paying a smaller amount of their income. And I don't know, I hear that and I just wonder, like, won't schools almost have an incentive to jack up their tuitions if a larger portion of the tuition will be subsidized by the government, like sort of like what we see with, you know, healthcare costs and insurance? And I wonder if, like, this is sort of, I don't know, not to quote Taylor Swift, but, you know, like a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. And, like, the real problem is actually just that higher education is way too expensive and we need to have some kind of cap on tuition or free tuition or something like that, because it's obviously unsustainable.
Sure. Yeah, I see that. But, I mean, the Republican counterargument to any Democratic policy can kind of act like a mirror ball, to quote Taylor Swift, and can kind of just reflect back the obverse of any argument. You know, like, the negative partisanship at this point is so strong that if Biden had done the opposite, you know, Ted Cruz would be out here saying, I'm a working class hero and I need to fight for the abolition of student debt. So there is no argument that won't have an equal and opposite reaction just on the level of politics.
Do you think that this is an issue that could have been claimed by the Republicans and that they could have made, you know, canceling student debt a policy of theirs? Or, I mean, because I feel like it just feels like an inherently liberal policy.
Oh, no, I totally think they could have and probably should have. I think it would have been smart politics for them. I mean, there is a larger sort of backdrop here of, like, are we entering a moment of populist realignment among the two parties? And sort of depends on what you mean by populist, depends on what you mean by realignment. But, like, I think there really is something to that, that, you know, you have this moment of Josh Hawley and Bernie Sanders uniting on relief checks. I mean, you can say that these things are in bad faith. You can say they're political theater. That all may be true, but, like, I think that a lot of politicians, both sort of mavericky, self-styled Republicans and more kind of socialist-y Dems, are seeing an opening of, okay, why don't we do stuff that helps people in a direct and tangible way and see if they like us more after we help them? Like, it's not exactly 3D chess, you know, because we've gotten to this point where politics is often people make these really arcane double bank shot arguments. Maybe if we make people repay their loans, they'll actually thank us because they'll learn the value of fiscal responsibility. I mean, you hear people around the Biden White House kind of overthinking every possible policy proposal when you report these stories. And it's like, okay, maybe you know what you're talking about. I'm just a simple journalist, but it seems to me that if you help people with the problems they're facing in their lives, and they know that you did it, and they remember that you did it, and then they go to the polls and maybe feel better about you, maybe they'll vote for you, and maybe you'll win the next election, and then maybe you can solve more of their problems. Like, that's how it's supposed to work. And I know, I don't want to be such a rube here that I, you know, skip over all the ways that, like, the signal and noise, you know, ratio can be broken, and people might not affiliate the policy you passed with the politician who passed it, and there might be all kinds of weird blowback effects. I mean, we know all those things happen, and so it's not a direct one-to-one. But in terms of lanes that are available in politics right now, the quote-unquote populist lane of, like, giving people stuff and hoping that they like it is, like, kind of an open lane.
Do you think that most of the people who will benefit from this plan weren't already voting for Biden or voting Democrat? So the plan covers people who are making under $125,000. So, you know, people who are making $100,000 and up are still technically covered by it. You know, it seems like most college-educated people go Democrat as opposed to Republican. And I was reading earlier that Biden has at least 200 aides who themselves will benefit from this plan because, you know, obviously a lot of people who go into government are also saddled with student loans. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, is this actually an example of the Democratic Party going after, like, voters who would have gone Republican, or is it just sort of like keeping the current contingent of voters happy?
Well, you know, they say there's turnout and there's persuasion and they both matter. There's also a third thing, which is getting people who have never voted to vote. And so you could argue that this isn't the most targeted program if you want to go after swing persuasion voters. But the fact is, like, every vote counts. And if it's mobilizing and turning out people who might not have come out to vote, that vote counts just as much as a persuasion vote. And also, again, like, I don't know how much we can trust the polls at this point. There has been some polling to suggest that they thought this would be a big win before the midterms, and it might not pan out that way because it might not be showing up in the polling the way people thought, or there might be a backlash to it. I guess what I would say in terms of, like, my skepticism about that is you can imagine a poll where you ask a Fox News viewer and they say, I give student debt relief a 1 out of 5. And you ask an MSNBC viewer and they give it a 5 out of 5. That's fine. That's a poll. But in terms of the enthusiasm gap or the intensity gap, the difference between somebody who watched a segment on TV that told them to not like this policy versus someone who actually had their debt wiped out, like, that's an immeasurable gap in intensity. The latter person is going to remember and they're going to vote possibly on the basis of that in 2 months. So, you know, there's only so much that you can say about, like, what is your opinion about this policy? But if it directly affects your life and next month you can pay your bills because you don't have to pay your student debt, like, you're not going to forget about that.
We'll have more with Andrew Marantz in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So we've been talking about this as if it's, you know, it's definitely going to happen and, you know, speculating on what the impact might be. But there has been a legal challenge that, you know, was filed earlier this week, and Republicans have sort of vowed to stop this plan. How likely do you think it is that people actually do get their debt canceled?
The issue, and this was Ted Cruz who was out there saying, I really want to sue over this. I just don't know how because I don't know who has standing. You know, standing being this legal concept of like who is injured by this policy, who can go before a court and say, I'm injured. And courts have not allowed just the taxpayer to do this. So you can't just go make the argument like I'm an American taxpayer and I'm harmed by this. Setting aside the question of whether taxpayers actually are harmed by this or not. So they were looking for someone with standing and they found this conservative legal group called the Pacific Legal Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they found this sort of tricky maneuver where one of their own employees said, okay, I live in Indiana, and if my debt were gradually canceled under the existing program over the next few years, I wouldn't have to pay tax on it. But if it's all wiped out now, I will have to pay $1,000 of tax on top of that. And so then I will be injured. My pocketbook will be injured. And so he was trying to say that he had standing to sue. But as soon as he presented that legal theory in the filings, the Biden administration just came out and said, okay, great. Well, so if you don't want to be automatically enrolled, you don't have to be. So the only way he could have experienced any financial injury is if he had been enrolled against his will in this debt relief program. And they said, okay, well, it's opt-in, not opt-out. And then the legal theory kind of crumbled. So it was a little bit of a cartoonish moment where, like, literally I was reading pieces saying, it looks like this lawsuit to the debt thing might not hold up. And then the pieces all had to be updated with like, and it has already fallen apart. So, you know, I think there will still be suits. And I think, who knows? I mean, given this court, they could do anything. You know, in the EPA versus West Virginia case last year, they ruled on a matter that was technically not really supposed to be justiciable. So they could do lots of things. And, you know, I would not at all be surprised if they say this is an overreach of federal power and they strike it down.
So during the pandemic, Trump was able to freeze student loans due to the national emergency that was happening. Do you think that what's happening now with Biden canceling student loans could be seen as like an extension of that, and that could actually be something that protects, you know, the plan in courts?
Yeah, it could. And I think that's their thinking, although it might backfire. So Biden a few times did the same thing Trump did, which was freezing the repayment of the loans without actually canceling them. Mm-hmm. And then when he finally canceled them, it was a little unclear based on how they were talking about it, under what authority they were doing that. Were they just doing it because they believe that the federal government or the executive just has the power to do that, or whether they are doing it because they have this special emergency power that's granted to them under this COVID national emergency. And it seems like, as of now, the most likely challenge to this would be some conservative group or some state attorney general saying, wait, if you're doing this under your emergency powers, why did it take you a year and a half to do it? Why did you do it so gradually? And what exactly is the COVID emergency here? So there are some legal analysts who think it would be stronger to just base the reasoning on the thing I was talking about before, the 1965 Higher Education Act, and just say, we have the power to do this, and not make it about COVID. But the idea of this kind of bold, let's just do it because we believe that we have the authority to do it, it's not really in the wheelhouse of a kind of incrementalist moderate like Joe Biden to do things that way. It seems like he always wants to split the baby. And so we'll see, but that might actually get him in more legal trouble than if he had just, you know, done it the bolder way. And I should also say, in my reporting on this, you know, I originally got involved with this idea first because I just thought it was interesting how the kind of quote unquote far left can push ideas into the mainstream. And I just think it was actually a remarkable and remarkably rapid success. I think we remember things like Occupy as, you know, oh, they kind of just fizzled out and there's kind of this like idealistic movement and they didn't achieve what they wanted to achieve. But actually, I do think there's a way of looking back and saying, they had this demand that the federal government should cancel student debt. Everyone laughed at them, including the most progressive members of government. And now it's a federal policy. And, you know, it's not a perfect federal policy. They don't think it's expansive enough. It might get struck down. But like, that is a pretty remarkable achievement. And I think there's actually a way of telling the story of a lot of the things that the Biden administration has been able to do that is as a capstone of progressive activism. It's weird because there's almost this reflexive narrative that whatever's going on, the left is kind of the child demanding a free lunch and the center is the adult in the room going, you know, now, there's no such thing as a free lunch and let's be sober-minded about this. When actually, weirdly, I think the story of the policy compromises of the Biden administration has been the far left of the party trying to pass Biden's agenda and the center trying to tank it. I mean, that's a little bit glib, but like you have like Ilhan Omar and AOC being like, let's pass Build Back Better. And then you have, you know, Josh Gottheimer and the kind of problem solvers trying to throw wrenches in it and Joe Manchin and all these people. So we can get down to specifics. That's a very broad narrative. But I think with student debt, with anything involving climate, with all kinds of stuff that used to be seen as, you know, twinkle in the eye of some activist somewhere, the fact that these things are not only being discussed, but they're like the centerpieces of federal legislation that is among the most ambitious legislation ever, and that the so-called bomb thrower progressives are the ones who are going to mat for the legislation and trying to pass a kind of watered down imperfect version of it. It's just kind of like so outside the standard narrative of political media that it almost kind of just gets ignored.
Biden, you know, people give him a hard time, but like I feel like when his presidency is over, if you look back at what it is that he accomplished, like it's a pretty progressive list of reforms. But for some reason, like the rollout is always like so shoddy or it takes so long for the thing to actually go through that like he doesn't really get the credit for it.
Yeah. I mean, it is this weird thing, right, where we're trying to figure out what is Biden's legacy in real time. And there was all this big inflated hope that Biden was going to be the next FDR. You know, you saw a lot of this on the left. And, you know, in fairness to that narrative, anytime there has been a big, you know, sort of realigner leftist president, they didn't start out as a leftist, right? FDR didn't start out as the great progressive hope. Lincoln didn't. I mean, these were all sort of moderates who were pushed by the left wing of their party. And so that was sort of the left's hope for Biden. That hope seemed to be dashed for a long time. Now it's kind of unclear. I mean, obviously, he's never going to be everything the left wants. But, you know, he passed this really big, by American standards, legislation, and it did a lot of stuff. Now, will he get credit for it in the midterms? I have no idea. I remain extremely skeptical that the Democrats can pull out wins in these midterms. And it doesn't always work that voters reward you for doing the thing you just did. There are many, many structural obstacles to that. But in terms of the narrative of like who Biden is in history, we won't really see for some time. Like, I think it'll be either Yeah, he's the guy who figured out how to integrate the demands of the left wing of his party and kind of move us past this kind of Reaganite neoliberal era and into something new. Or he's the guy who could not figure out how to do that and just wanted to make compromises even when they didn't really make policy or political sense. And, you know, he just kind of dropped the ball. So I think it's too early to tell. I think Biden kind of wants to be all things to all people, it seems. And that's just never really possible.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. This is great.
Andrew Marantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Michelle Moses with support from Sidney Cobb. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thank you so much for listening.